You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. And you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is The Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
And welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on Mission Control, we have Jay. Well, this evening, we are pleased to present the second in a series of five Space Show programs in which we examine the current and possible future policies governing Australia's space activities. In particular, we address the vexed issue of whether we should have our own space agency, or should we join another regional space agency, such as the European Space Agency, or should we continue as we have done in the past 7 decades without a space agency? Warwick Holmes is an engineer who worked for many years at the European Space Agency. He firmly believes Australia should become a member of that agency. He set out his views at the Melbourne Final Frontier Festival at Melbourne University. He was introduced by Joel Patterson, who is an honours student in international politics at Monash University in Clayton.
And finally, Warwick Holmes. Warwick has worked in Europe for 29 years, designing, building, testing and launching spacecraft for the European Space Agency. Warwick has built 10 different spacecraft with a total mass successfully in orbit of 37 tonnes, including scientific, Earth observation, telecoms, interplanetary exploration, global navigation systems and manned spacecraft programs, all valued at over $1 billion. Warwick has performed 5 launch campaigns from the ESA launch base using the Ariane 3, Ariane 4, Ariane 5 and Soyuz STB rockets.
In a 24-minute speech, Warwick set out the case for Australia joining the European Space Agency.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming today. I hope to present a talk which will complement those which have already been given, and that is picking up on Owen's historical stories about what Australia did many, many years ago and lamenting the fact that we lost a lot of that, those opportunities from those early days. And then picking up from what, Jason said about the new paradigm in space technology and these disruptive technologies, making CubeSats to address the new generation of spacecraft engineering. And finally, what Brett was saying, and that is that Australia's had these long-term agreements, strategic alliance policies, with defence, with the United States. And what I hope to present to you today is how what I'm going to present to you is an agreement that I would like to have between Australia and the European Space Agency could encompass all of those three talks together, and I'll explain how. So, first of all, there was a picture which Brett showed of the rocket in Woomera. That picture was taken 50 years ago, and that was, in fact, a European rocket, and the rocket's called ELDO, called Europa, and it's made by the European Launch Development Organisation. Now, I don't know if you know, but 10 of these rockets were launched out of Woomera, and they're more than 100 tonnes each, and they're on the back of a cancelled British programme called Blue Streak. But Europe then decided it wanted autonomy in its own, making its own launch vehicles, and they came out to Australia to use our facilities here for doing their early rocket development. And I'm going to show you a video here of one of the launches out of Australia's launch base here in Woomera. And this rocket weighed more than 100 tonnes. It delivered 137 tonnes of thrust. 10 of these were launched from Australia. So if we think we never had any technology or any interest in space engineering, 50 years ago, this is what we were doing. Now, watch this video carefully. This is an enormous rocket, made 50 years ago, launched from Australia. It uses liquid oxygen and kerosene with the fuels, quite simple. First stage was made by the British, second stage by the French, called Coralie, and the third stage was German. And the technology in these days, this was absolutely leading technology in the world for, in this case, making rockets. Now, this is what Australia was doing 50 years ago with the Europeans. And unfortunately, at the end of this program, Australia then pulled out of what was then, this is called European Launch Development Organization, which has now become ESA. But we're the only country that has ever left ESA. ESA today has now 22 countries, and my argument today will be to try and go back and join them again, and I'll explain why. So some of the technology which ESA has, which is still, which you can see here in Australia today, is this is one example of how, I think Kerry was giving examples of the spin-offs in the space industry. Well, the solar cells made from ESA have won more of these solar cell car challenges than any other international team. And that is, there's been five races, won five out of 13 races in the last 28 years, and they're using the triple junction gallium arsenide solar cells, which we use on the Rosetta program. And I think with the MPPT, which is the maximum power point tracker, which gives you the most efficient transfer of solar power into mechanical energy electrically for the wheels. This car went top speed at 160 kilometres an hour. Because of this, they had to impose a speed limit. Because it was going so fast, that people would start getting killed. So I think the speed limit now is 120 kilometres an hour, respecting the road rules. But they've had other engineering factors put in just to make them safer. And you see here the ESA logo because of the solar cells. Today, ESA is still in Australia. We've got ground tracking stations. This big one on the right was the dedicated ground station made for the Rosetta mission, 35-metre diameter. Another smaller one, which is now used for tracking the Ariane 5 launch vehicles as they're coming out of French Guiana. And this is $60 million to build. This is now $85 million in real terms. Was built by a Canadian company in Australia. So why are the Canadians building ESA telescopes, ESA hardware, in Australia? Now, the reason is... I'll get back to that, sorry. So, the introduction, you heard that I'd worked for ESA for 29 years, built on 29 years building ESA missions. And the question is, well, what's it like to work for ESA? Well, this is a video that was made for me. It was actually a present that was given to me by one of the German engineers I was managing on the X-ray multi-mirror mission. So, Owen was mentioning... that Australia made an X-ray telescope. Well, ESA then went off and made one. So this is what I did for 29 years, working with ESA. So what is ESA? ESA is an international organisation of 22 countries with a cooperating membership with Canada and these other countries, Argentina, Brazil, China, which have reciprocal arrangements for sharing technologies. ESA is not part of the European Union. People will be surprised to hear that. It's a separate, independent European organisation. So, for example, the UK will stay with ESA, despite Brexit, because it's not the European Union. Norway and Switzerland are not in the European Union, but they are with ESA. So to call it the European Space Agency is actually a bit of a misnomer. It's an international space organisation. They've had more than 40 successful missions in the last 50 years, every single one of them using international cooperation. Annual budget is about $6 billion. That's the leverage you get when you join ESA. You get $6 billion a year being spent on doing spacecraft technology. And the opportunity is shared proportionally, amongst the member states. So, and the working language, luckily, is English for me. Even though they say, officially, it's also French and German, in the 29 years I've worked for them, I've never, ever been to a meeting which they spoke French or German. So it is, in fact, always English. They have about 2,000 staff, but they have industrial contracts supporting over 100,000 employees in the space industry. So why join ESA? Well, ESA's constitution guarantees a return, they actually say 100%, but in reality it turns out to be about 99%, of all the contributions given to ESA come back to the member states. So if Australia was to join ESA and we gave $20 million a year to ESA, that $20 million actually comes straight back. So why give it to ESA in the first place? The whole idea of joining ESA is that we get the benefit and the leverage of 50 years of engineering experience, building spacecraft and launch vehicles and whatever technology we might be interested in. So it's actually like joining a club which has got an enormous amount of engineering experience and expertise. And they just help us to build our own technology here in Australia with a one-for-one return with all the money given by the Australian government. So ESA would actually welcome Australia's membership because for three times they've actually tried to invite Australia to join. The first time was back then in 1972, when Australia pulled out of ESA when we finished the launch campaign testing, and there's been two other occasions as well. When I'm promoting a membership with ESA, with Australia, I am not talking about astronauts, or building the ISS, or even building rockets. going to Mars or even landing on comets, because that's the high end of space. Very expensive, very glamorous. But for Australian taxpayers, our first foray into building serious spacecraft should not be doing these high-end, very exotic missions. We should be focusing on remote sensing and telecommunications, which are the more economically viable and interesting returns for Australian taxpayers. So, in the same way, I use this example here, the same way that we all know the effect that GPS has had on navigation when you're driving your car around, for example, remote sensing has an enormous improvement for the agricultural output for farmers, because from space you can measure fertilisation, irrigation, pests, water pollution, minerals, etc. So this is why building large remote sensing spacecraft with ESA would be an extremely cost-effective and have a huge value for taxpayers investing in space with an organisation that's had an enormously successful history in the last 50 years of building these kind of spacecraft. So the example I like to use, a bit like Owen did, is that Canada has been an associate member, or a cooperating member state, they call it now, for 37 years. So for almost four decades, the Canadians figured out that ESA is an extremely good international organisation to get involved with if you're interested in doing space engineering. Now, I've listed here a whole series of similarities between Australia and Canada in terms of our GDP, in terms of the exchange rate, economic comparisons, population densities, the fact that we're both Commonwealth countries, same democratic parliamentary system, even our demographies, average age, income distributions. We're all, everything here in Australia is very, very similar to Canada, except that Canada is a large cold country and Australia is a large hot country. And that's effectively the only difference. Now, they also have to be very careful with their strategic and military agreements with the United States. They have an 8,000 kilometre border with the United States. So there's no other country in the world that has to be more nervous of not upsetting the Americans militarily than Canada. And that's the same thing with Australia as well. We have to respect, we've got these ANZUS alliance and these defence agreements with the Americans, and they give us a lot of data associated with Pine Gap. ESA has got nothing to do with that. ESA is a civilian space agency, and we're only interested in developing applications and spacecraft for the good of civilian use and civilian applications. And I say at the very end here, the most frustrating thing for me is that Australia has refused three times invitations from ESA to join their organisation. We're the only country that has ever, ever, ever been invited to join ESA, which is unusual because normally countries are banging on the door to join the European Space Agency, particularly Argentina, Brazil and Israel. But they've been blocked for political reasons, which no one's going to, but that's just ESA's just said no. But they would like to join, Australia to join, but we have said no three times. So what does Canada get from ESA? Now, this is an economic discussion because, you know, what does it cost for Australia to join ESA? Well, Canada has almost exactly the same GDP as Australia. And so this is a perfect reference because the contributions that you make to ESA are based on your GDP. There's an option, there are two ways you can join ESA. One is the mandatory payment, one is the optional payment. Mandatory is the bare minimum you have to pay, which is $5 million in the case of Canada, which would then be $5 million in the case of Australia. And for that, the mandatory programs are you have to spend that money in space science, because ESA is formed from two organisations, European Launch Development Organisation and the European Space Research Organisation. And because of that original scientific origin of ESA, they insist now that the bare minimum that you do if you want to join their organisation is you must put the mandatory funding into space science. The optional program is that if you're happy with ESA, you can put a bit more money and you can get to do other things which you elect to choose to do. In the case of Canada, they've put 38% extra money into Earth observation and 38% into satellite communications. I think this is a perfect model for Australia as well, in that, again, going back to those examples of what space applications give us the most bang for the buck? Well, it's looking at farming, optimising our agriculture, our major primary industry, and communications, when you look at things like NBN Co. and Optus and AusSat. Then the space science. Now, space science involves the other programs which the most famously are things like Rosetta for the and all the interplanetary science projects as well. Now, what's missing from here is any administration cost. Well, that's the good news with ESA, is that there is no administration cost with ESA, because the commercial spin-offs that they've made from their developments in Eutelsat and EUMETSAT, which is a weather monitoring company and a telecommunications company, together with some money which they also get from the European Union, that pays for the administration costs. So there is every dollar we give to ESA goes straight into space technology back here in Australia, with the leverage and all the experience of all the success they've had in the last 50 years. And the final economic argument, too, is that three independent Canadian university economic studies from three different universities, McGill, one in Quebec, and I forget the third one, have said that they've all come up with this same figure, that for every dollar that Canada has given to ESA, there's been a $3.50 benefit in terms of licensing products, intellectual property, just the economic feedback has this 3.5% multiplier from specifically the Canadian investment with ESA. And that too, I mean, that's a simple economic fact. It's not a projection that I would like to say to you today, if Australia joins ESA, then we could get $3.50 back. Canada right now, for 37 years, as I've been speaking, has been getting $3.50 back for every dollar they've invested. So there's no economic argument not to join ESA. I'm using the example of $20 million a year because Canada puts in a bit more electively, as you can see in the optional programs. I think a good starting figure for Australia would be $20 million, and we would get to do the same work that they do in Earth observation and satellite communications and get all the advantage of all the experience they've had for 50 years. So here's just another example. 1988, an Australian engineer is working in Canada on an ESA satellite. Why? Well, the Australian engineer was me, but it could be anyone in this room who wants to do engineering. This is a telecommunications satellite, the biggest one that was made in the world at its time. It's the largest civilian telecommunications satellite called Olympus. And I'm in each of these stupid pictures. This is, again, just from my photo album. But V-32 was the last Ariane 3 rocket that was launched from French Guiana. So this is a long, long time ago. This is, you know, almost 30 years ago. This is the kind of engineering that was going on in ESA 30 years ago. Okay? Now here again, this is a photograph looking at the front. Again, 1988, an Australian engineer helped to design, build, test and launch this ESA telecommunications satellite in Canada. Because this is an example of where the offset of the technology and the work, because Canada was a member of ESA, this spacecraft was built and tested in Canada. And I worked over there for 2.5 years. I then went down to French Guiana and did the first launch campaign. So, you know, why? Why am I doing this? Why is an Australian working in Canada, building a spacecraft like this, 27 years later, is another example. This is not ESA. This is the SkyMuster NBN Co. spacecraft. 6 tons, built entirely by Loral Space and Systems in America. Not 1 milligram of this spacecraft ever touched Australian soil. It got launched by the Europeans using an Ariane 5 from French Guiana. Not a single Australian was involved in the design, building and testing and launch of this rocket, of this spacecraft. Why? 27 years ago, I was doing this one, but today, Australia is doing nothing on a spacecraft like this. This is the modern version of that, okay? Now, the worst part of this story, too, is that this spacecraft shared a launch with a satellite called ARSAT, which was an Argentinian satellite, which weighed 3 tons, about half the size of this one. The difference with ARSAT was that it was entirely built and designed and tested in Argentina. Argentina, a third world country in terms of its economics. And yet they had the technology to build a 3-ton telecommunications satellite, and it's now being operated entirely by their own people, launched by the Europeans. Yet today, this, together with all the AusSat spacecraft, all the Optus spacecraft, no Australians have ever been involved in design, building and testing and launching of these things because they are the intellectual property of the companies who make them. There's the ITAR restrictions that Jason mentioned. And the only Australian engineering involvement is in specification. We say what we want, very precisely, but the building and the intellectual property and the experience is all American in the case of the telecommunications satellites for Australia. This is the kind of work that we could be doing in Europe with ESA and getting first-hand, direct experience of how to build this kind of spacecraft, like the Argentinian satellite, in Australia. Okay, so what is Australia doing today? Well, these are the future spacecraft, which are currently defined, that are going to be built in Australia in the next year or two. And all of them are nanosats, or CubeSats, which we've heard a few things about today. So this, unfortunately, is the scale of spacecraft engineering that Australia is doing on its own. Nothing wrong with CubeSats. They're very small. They're very capable for the volume which they have. But this is the tiny end of spacecraft engineering. And it's been done principally by universities. Now, universities generally don't build spacecraft. In the same way, when you want an operation, you don't go to a university to have an operation. You go to a hospital. The doctor who was trained in the university, but you go to the hospital. If you want a lawyer, you don't go to a university, you go to the chambers. Despite the fact that lawyers and doctors are trained in universities, you don't go to those universities to speak to a lawyer or have an operation. But for spacecraft engineering, for some reason, in Australia, we think only universities build spacecraft. That's not true. Industry builds spacecraft, and that's what ESA's all about, is developing space industries in companies, in the countries, sorry, that join their organisation. And every new member of ESA has had ESA come in and help set up the engineering, the standards, the technology for helping to build their spacecraft. So there's been an example too that we've tried before building small satellites in Australia. And these are three examples which were much larger than the CubeSats I mentioned on the previous slide. Unfortunately, they all got cancelled. And this is another problem with small spacecraft, is that they're very easy to cancel. An agreement with ESA is legally binding. You have to sign up for 10 years, and you give that money in advance, it's paid each year, but you've got a legal obligation to follow through and build spacecraft, full stop. These things are so easy to cancel, and I can give you 30 spacecraft examples in Australia in the last 30 years which have been cancelled. Some of them were mentioned previously. And I have to very strongly support Brett when he said there's a crazy headline in the Northern Territory newspaper about a rocket that's going to be built there. I've got 16 reasons, technically, why that project will never, ever, ever get off the ground. But if they're involved with ESA, they would definitely find the solution. I mean, I could tell them as well, but they're not interested. So this is part of the problem, is that we don't have the experience to do these things on our own. Here's a good example. ESA in Australia, on the left. This is me. I was working on the ATV, Autonomous Transfer Vehicle, which refuels the space station. On the right is a photograph that was taken just a few weeks ago of a CubeSat that's being tested in Canberra. I was working on this spacecraft on the left more than 10 years ago. Okay? And it's the equivalent of a 30,000U spacecraft. Okay? Now, I'm not trying to show off. I'm simply telling you fact. There's another Australian standing at the base of a massive spacecraft, right? This is not a fantasy or fairy tale. It is fact. And this was done 12 years ago, in fact. Now, this is ESA. This is the benefit you get by joining together 22 European countries and other countries, combining $6 billion of the economic force of putting all those resources together, and you get to build spacecraft like this. As a member state, you get to see everything. You don't get just a small proportion according to what you pay for. You get to see and do everything. That was why I was managing the launch of XMM. That was why I gave these countdowns to start the Rosetta mission. What the hell is an Australian doing in these kind of situations? But that's the opportunity you get with ESA, okay? For $20 million a year. So I'm pushing this hard because I've now left ESA. I have no benefit, I've done it all. I think there's a lot of people in this room who are very interested in space, would love to do things. Well, I left Australia for 29 years, and I had to do it over in Europe. If we join ESA as an associate member, the work is done here in Australia. That's the way it works. That's why all the Canadian work was done in Canada. That's why I went to Canada, just because it was an ESA project done in Canada. Here's an example of the electronics of a CubeSat on the right and the electronics of ATV on the left. This is what I worked on for 4 years. Testing the software and building the hardware of this avionics bay. Question is, how big is it? Well, it's that big. That's the second bay. There are actually two of them. I lied. There are two bays of electronics. Compare the size of that, the complexity. Every single box of electronics is several times larger than the entire CubeSat. Okay? There's ATV in space. We made six of them. Not just one. We made six. They resupplied the space station with food, water, oxygen, fuel, scientific equipment, and it did the orbit corrections. This module is used for lifting the entire space station. It's got a 4-ton thrust on its engines. On the right, for the same period, poor old Australia, nothing. They're still building those CubeSats. Nothing has yet been launched. No, again, I'm not trying to rub it in, but it's a fact. It's an absolute pure fact, I'm telling you. Okay, here's another example. XMM, this is the video that you saw. Australia made FedSat back in 2002. And it was actually made by the platform was made by an English company called Space Innovations Limited that luckily went bankrupt. And the final building of the spacecraft was actually completed in Australia together with integration of the six payload instruments that were made. So we actually did some fantastic work on this small, this is a mini satellite. It's about 60 centimetres cubed. Yeah. And on the left is XMM. So there's a comparison of the number of scientific papers. Okay, 700 times as many PhDs have come out of XMM. More than 3,000 times of the citation references and reads have come out of XMM. Yet, XMM cost 25 times FedSat. So for 25 times, you get 700 to 3,000 times the throughput. Rosetta, okay, again, there's another story. Don't have much time, I'm afraid. But I was an avionics system engineer that worked on that for 4.5 years and has now landed on the comet successfully. And so with Australia, I'm sorry, there's no comparison that I can think of. Okay, so the final story is ESA in Australia equals technical innovation, remote sensing, Earth observation, telecommunications, everything that we want to do. It's not rocket science, but it is time to catch up. And this is the message I want to leave you with today as to why I think Australia should become an associate member state of ESA for $20 million a year. And that's the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Warwick.
Warwick Holmes, a former engineer at the European Space Agency who has resettled back home in Australia. You're listening to The Space Show and a special on Australia's space policy. Well, as Australians flounder around debating what they should do in space and wring their hands over lost opportunities, things are different across the Tasman. In New Zealand, in partnership with American company Rocket Labs USA, they are building rockets to launch satellites into low Earth orbit. David Broadbent is a robotics engineer with Rocket Labs in Auckland. He had this question for Warwick Holmes.
All right, my name's David Broadbent. I'm a robotics engineer. I'm also a diesel mechanic by trade through the CAT organisation and Rolls-Royce trained engineer as well. Very recently, I was in Auckland working for Rocket Labs USA on their new rocket as a vehicle test engineer on the base stage. You ask, why is an Australian in New Zealand working on a rocket rather than here? The obvious answer is we don't have it. And I would say the number of Australians working on that rocket in New Zealand, I could count not on that hand, not on both hands, but both hands and both feet, and then look for somewhere else to count them. The thing I'm seeing is we've got technology that we had in Woomera. I was in Woomera. I've seen a lot of stuff having travelled the world. The quandary I'm seeing is, why is Australia not joining ETSA? If it's the lack of funding, I'll stick my hand up and offer you $20 million and I'll create a private group to generate that $20 million and join them as a private company to this private commercial space agency. I've got a defence clearance. I'm a defence contractor. I can't see why does it need government to actually be the one to join? Why can we not join ourselves as a corporation, as a group of Australian engineers at the least?
Okay, look, there's a simple answer to that question, and that is that ESA will only deal with federal governments. And the reason they do that is to guarantee that there's long-term, legally binding agreements. If you're going to commit 10 years of funding, it's got to be there, and it's got to be bipartisan. So whichever government comes in, whether it's Liberal or Labor, they will continue to pay the $20 million a year. So this is true of most international organisations, that they'll only negotiate with federal governments, okay? And that's correct. So again, that's our fault for not having a federally, a single focal point for federal government space agency work, okay? $20 million a year. In Australia, we spend $30 billion on the Department of Defence. We could join ESA 1,500 times every year compared to what we spend in military money. So if the United States is worried about us joining ESA, I don't think they've got much to worry about, because it's 1,500th of our annual expenditure would be them joining fee for ESA. But to just get to your answer your question, we must have a central federal government agency to negotiate with ESA.
Warwick Holmes' assertion that Australia should join the European Space Agency prompted a lot of energetic discussion at the Final Frontier Festival, which was organised by the Melbourne Space Program Group. Comments came from Richard Tonkin, Brett Biddington and Owen Mace. Both Richard and Owen were members of the Melbourne University group that built Oscar Australis 5, the first built and second launched Australian satellite. Brett is the owner of Biddington Research Proprietary Limited in Melbourne.
My name's Richard Tonkin. I, with Owen Mace, who was the first presenter this afternoon, built the first satellite in Australia. We called it Australis, and it was an amateur radio satellite. It was launched by NASA in 1970. After that happened, none of us who were in our early 20s were able to go into space industry in Australia because there wasn't one. My children weren't able to go into the space industry in Australia because there wasn't one, and I now have grandchildren, and I hope that they can. I'm now an old man. I walk with a stick, and I sincerely hope that that my grandchildren may be able to participate in the Australian Space Program. Now, my question, after all that, is to Bruce. Bruce, can you think of any reason why we shouldn't join ESA?
There are actually a lot of reasons why we shouldn't join ESA. Let me put on two hats. Let me sort of be the government hat for the moment. The government will be reluctant to join ESA because it's not the United States, and our alliance is with the United States, and space stuff is done with the United States, not with Europe, and we don't trust the French. And Brexit and all that actually doesn't help. Warwick's point is right. ESA is not going to be affected in quite the same way as the EU, but there's been a huge fight brewing in Europe behind the scenes about who controls space in Europe, between the EU and ESA, and the two ways that's been set up politically. And the EU is falling apart. It's going to take a decade, but it's falling apart. And I think, so with my government hat on and thinking about what I've just said, ESA is no longer a very good investment. It might have been some time previously, but I think that the government will be very, very reluctant to take this on board. The other thing is now cost, $20 million. $20 million for any science program in this country is huge. It shouldn't be, but it is. We had $40 million for the Australian Space Research Program 5 or 6 years ago. We turned that into something way beyond $46 million. The multiplier absolutely works. We know that. But ultimately, I come back to strategy, politics, and say, it's not going to happen, even though the logic that is put before us makes it seem very attractive. Final point. If we join ESA, that means there has to be a space agency. You've got to ask yourself what a space agency will do. A space agency to do coordination and make friends with the world makes sense, and Australia loses out because we don't have that function as well articulated in government as we should. Unfortunately, and this comes particularly from a couple of rowdy academics, they advocate for a space agency effectively so that they don't have to compete through the ARC, the Australian Research Council grants process, on an equal playing field with peers to get money. They see actually an Australian space agency as a shortcut to grants for them, as opposed to having to have to argue against all the others who want money out of grants programs. Government is not going to allow rent-seeking behaviour to persist. If they were to shut up and turn the argument around and start talk about collaboration, start talk about innovation and change their language, that would strengthen the argument hugely. Finally, space agency, if it were to be set up, would be a small organisation, 50, 100. And small organisations, the way that we structure our bureaucracies and fund them, are exceptionally vulnerable. If the Department of Defence loses a 5% cut, they wouldn't even know. But if you take 5% of people out of any small agency, think of the War Memorial, and they had a 5% cut a few years ago, told government they'd be closing on Sunday. They were told they were given, therefore, an exception. So you've got to think about some of the really hard nut stuff here to get through this. And so I'm a pessimist. It appeals to me from my heart, but I think that the head will say that it's not going to happen, I'm afraid. Warwick, you should comment.
Okay, well, from my perspective, Australia's had this long-term agreements with the United States, with Defence, with Pine Gap, this kind of thing. But having said that, so has Canada, and that's why I made the point of saying that they've got an 8,000-kilometre common border. So nobody could be more nervous of upsetting the United States in military or strategic terms.
Trump's going to build a fence.
Mr. Trump's going to build a fence. So I'd like to think that the Canadians checked with the Americans when they joined ESA. They said, listen, do you mind? And they sort of almost scoffed at them, saying, well, look, what are you asking us that stupid question for? Because that's a civilian agency, and it has nothing to do with what we're doing. And this is why I don't know why the Australian government is nervous about upsetting the Americans, because it's got nothing to do with any military agreements or ANZUS or Pine Gap or anything. So I don't know why the Australian government thinks like that, but for whatever the reason they do it, it's simply wrong. Okay. Now, as far as the space agency is concerned, that's true. ESA will only negotiate directly with a federal government space agency. To me, that's another reason why we should have one, and I think Jason had it in his slide, and there's many other people. With the politics behind how we ask for that and changing the language, I don't know, but we do need one. New Zealand has just announced they have set up their space agency, which was the last... excuse me. that which was the last remaining country in the OECD. We are the only country in the 35 nations of the OECD, except for Iceland, which has 1/75th the size of our country, okay? The only country that does not have a space agency. This is Australia, yeah? Even New Zealand, last week, announced they have a national space agency.
You've got to then say what they're going to do, Warwick, which is do what Australia did in terms of international law and signing treaties 30 and 40 years ago. I mean, it's,
okay.
it's
but
what, a name.
But that's not a reason for us not to have a space agency. Yeah.
That's been done already. You know, so that's not an argument to do it.
Okay, no, but I'm presenting an argument for why we need a space agency, because that means we can then engage with ESA, for example. Yeah? Yeah.
I'll just have a very quick go at that. Perhaps there's another way. I make an observation that the Mars rovers have meteorological sensors on them, wind sensors and so on and so on. Have a guess, and some of you will know, have a guess who supplies that the MET sensors and why. The answer is that it's a company called Visala. They come from Finland.
And one other thing which you should know too is that there's a microprocessor chip in the Mars rovers that's actually made in Australia. It's from a company called Silana. But they sell them to the States and they get put in their hardware and we never hear from them ever again. So Australia does have this technology. I think it's just very sad that there's these tiny little companies trying to desperately get involved in space engineering. And yet if we were to join a much larger organisation and who have the experience of project management and all these huge resources. I always like to use the example of, imagine if you're interested in playing golf. Now, there's two ways you can play golf. You can buy 100 acres of land. You can start with $100 million. You can buy 100 acres of land. You can get lots of landscape gardeners to come in, and you can build the clubhouse. You have to do all of that before you hit your first golf ball. Or you can enjoy an existing club. And the only money you're spending is the green fees and the annual membership. Well, that's what ESA is. ESA has got this huge golf course with Club Pro and all the facilities there ready for you to use, and you can get straight onto the fairway and start hitting golf balls. Now, what I'm seeing in Australia today is we're trying to build the first fairways with our CubeSats. That is a very, very ineffective, inefficient, not effective way to spend taxpayers' money. But it's not even taxpayers' money in most cases. But this is what I'm saying. If the government is really, really interested in innovation, and we keep constantly hearing that from both parties, then why the hell don't they do it effectively and cost-effectively and join an international organisation? We've got international agreements for our defence. Why don't we have it with civilian space? And I don't think we need to be nervous about the existing military agreements with the Americans. I don't believe that's any reason at all why we cannot join a civilian space agency, ESA.
On 88.3 Sullen FM, this is The Space Show with Andrew and Jay. Last year's Final Frontier Festival was held in the run-up to the 2016 federal election. I asked the policy panellists whether the election would have any effect on Australia's space policy. Jason Held, the founder of Saver Astronautics in Sydney, and Brett Beddington, the owner of Beddington Research Proprietary Limited in Melbourne, responded.
We had a question come in off Twitter, I believe, from Lisa, who says, with an election tomorrow, is the best chance for an Australian space industry with Malcolm Turnbull, Bill Shorten, or Richard Di Natale?
It's completely irrelevant. That's the answer. The future of space in Australia is commercial. I think that's what we're getting out of this entire debate. Do we go to ESA? Do we not? Like, if we went to ESA, that'd be awesome. I'd be in both hands in the air. And I think a couple of other startups here would be as well. It doesn't matter who takes the leadership next as far as making a decision for a space agency. I think there have been some positive overtures with the current government saying, okay, we get that sign, but the overtures are happening because the space community is actually forming.
Yep.
All right. 10 years ago, there was nothing here. There was no commercials. Exactly as Brett said, it's like, okay, academics trying to get more money outside of an ARC research grant. Now we've got people who are trying to build stuff to make money for it, and that's self-sustaining. And the government's responding to it. I could tell you this. The state-level governments in New South Wales is 100% bullish on both sides of the aisle. I think if Liberal or Labor, I think both sides would be open to it. It's up to us as a community to take that seed that we're developing and build it up into something that the government can get behind. And then, you know, then we can have our space agency, then we could join ESA, and at least we can make an argument for it where they can say, oh, but we don't do space, but no, wait a second, we do. And then the argument, by the way, is, well, we spend $5 billion a year on other people's space programs, let's take $20 million of that and throw it into ESA or throw it into something else that makes sense.
If I can just add, perhaps my point, and I haven't given you my personal view about this, but I'm going to now. The ESA argument will get traction in 4 or 5 years' time. I think it's a little early just yet. I think there are some steps to go first. So you're right, Jason, it doesn't matter which party gets into office tomorrow. It's going to be commercially led. It's the little germs that have been running around that have led the government to review the Space Activities Act. Instead of being bashed over the head, you need a different act. Governments don't like being bashed over the head. They tend not to respond too well. But rather, there's been another group of men and women underneath just quietly saying, we'd like to do stuff. Will you help us, please? And remember, you're going to reduce red tape. You are stopping us from doing business while you continue this. That has resonated. And that's been a very important driver in why the Act has been currently reviewed. Government will respond, and similarly, with you come to the ESA argument, if at some point we have a bunch of large commercial institutions saying to government, you know, we can't build an innovation ecosystem without a component that has a space aspect to it, at that point, government will start to respond again. That's when I think the $20 million comes right into play. And as you point out, Warwick, it's absolutely small change.
So on the point of that, Nick asks, isn't the real issue here really about the overly prohibitive legislation? With the Space Activities Act being reviewed at the moment, our capabilities hang in the balance depending on whether any reforms can be implemented.
I would say that the Space Activities Act review, don't think of this as a negative but as a positive, and think about how we've been able, as a community that Jason's talking about, with careful and sustained, if you like, conversation with government, to move to the point that the Act is now being reviewed. Governments don't move fast. There's lots and lots of inertia. The fact that they've even opened the door to conversation is a huge change in attitude and heart. So be optimistic about this, but also, sadly, I have to say, be patient.
Well, that election returned the coalition to government with so far no significant change in Australia's space policies. The Turnbull government is as careful to avoid the term space policy as was the Gillard and Rudd governments. The official term is Australian Satellite Utilisation Policy. So why has the Space Industry Association of Australia chosen now to come out with a call for an Australian space agency? Alice Gorman, an advisory council member of the Space Industry Association, has this thought on the political timing of the call.
One of the reasons that we have chosen to present the white paper now is because we feel that politically the time is right for to promote this, particularly to the politicians who are starting to understand the critical importance of space services to Australia's future. So we're very fortunate that we've received a good hearing from them, and we're looking forward to collaborating more closely with them.
One participant at the Final Frontier Festival had an idea on how to promote government support for space.
Notice briefly that just let all tell people, because I am a little bit late. I was originally applying to be a speaker as well. I want just to say that while I'm attempting I started 3 years ago, Australian-owned space agency, which is building Australian-owned rocket. And my organization is called Space Y, because it's like inspired by the SpaceX. So it's a private company, because we can't rely on government, so we do privately everything. And also I got idea, basically, create some sort of hybrid to create the gap between the problems we have with this political lockup, basically. So what I call basically my company is as a small incumbent of this Australian Space Agency, which I take this liberty to tracking and organizing, linking all the people in Australia. And when once we got this unofficial organization, then we can get a political push to get actually succeed, and government will need to recognize, because once we got this running rocket, running satellites on launch from Australia, everything is done like this way, then just government will join into it. Because like if you build a cars, for example, when you got a factory which is building cars, then you must, government just approve it. But so this is good idea, which was not possible before. It's a good inspiration and for all people in here, because these people were working for 50 years, like those banging by the head to the wall, trying to get something. So this is a very good idea, inspiration by Mr. Elon Musk, that you need to wait for any stupid government. You can do it yourself.
Warwick Holmes sees membership of the European Space Agency as a way Australia can circumvent the American restrictions under the ITAR laws.
Just regarding the ITAR issue that Brett just mentioned, one of the good points with ESA is that there are no ITAR restrictions. So everything there is shared. Intellectual property, same thing. Is that, you know, you don't join ESA if you're going to try and hide things. It's all about sharing technology. So we are not constrained with those problems either. My greatest regret is that Australia was the fifth member of ESA in those days back in 1964. ESA, ELDO, European Launch Development Organisation, which has now become ESA. We were a member of that organization, and we left it. And this is the thing that drives me crazy. Look at the size of those rockets who are being launched out of Woomera 50 years ago, and today we're scrambling to make CubeSats and to make any kind of space technology at all. This is just so wrong in so many levels, because we were one of the first members of ESA, and now we're begging you to get us back in again. Look what I've done. I've done all that. I've finished. I've had enough. back in Australia now. I've finished my engineering after 29 years. And I think it's very sad that I've been spoiled rotten by the opportunities I've had as an Australian engineer who wanted to do space by ESA. Now, the one thing I forgot to mention to you is I have a British passport. And that's the only reason I could work with ESA. That's the only reason, okay? So I'm cheating a bit. But I'm an Australian. I did 24 years of my education in this country. Well, sorry, my first 24 years was high school, primary school, university. I went to Sydney University. And then my very, very first job was over in Europe. And for 29 years, once I got there, I never came back. It was so interesting. Why?
But that's the point. You have to be a European citizen.
No.
Or a member of a country that is associated and joined.
Correct. Right. And that's why I want Australia to join ESA, like Canada. Canada is not Europe, okay? No. Canada is an associate member.
A bit earlier you said anybody in this room can be a
member. As Australians. You're all Australians here, aren't you?
But wait a minute. The catch is we have to persuade the government to join ESA for that to be able to...
Okay.
You haven't quite made that clear.
All right, okay. If Australia joins ESA, then anyone in this room can... two points. A, the capability. I was an Australian engineer, educated here, okay, and I could make it. You saw the level that I got to within ESA, okay? And that's just because I was a good engineer and I was very keen, okay? But also, I had a British passport, okay? Now, if Australia joins ESA... then anyone in this room can join. Okay, I thought that was obvious, but okay. So this is why I'm trying to encourage Australia's government to join ESA. Okay.
But what is ITAR? ITAR. Well, it is a United States law that restricts the export of high technology to foreign countries, and believe it or not, the United States government regards Australia as a foreign country. That limits our access to rocket and satellite technology. Not only the physical parts, but also the intellectual property. And we turn now to one of those European Space Agency projects that Warwick Holmes worked on, and we have a summary of the Rosetta mission.
The Rosetta mission. For centuries, humans have gazed at comets blazing in the night sky, from ancient civilizations to early astronomers, right up to the current generation of space scientists and engineers who created a daring mission to explore a comet up close. The mission is called Rosetta. The team behind it? The European Space Agency. The Rosetta team have overcome many challenges. Its first launch was aborted, missing the chance to visit comet 46P, but they had a backup, 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko. After 10 years of travelling through space to play catch-up with a comet, Rosetta launched a small probe called Philae to land on 67P in November 2014. However, the harpoons and the rocket designed to lock the probe onto the surface failed to fire. Little Philae, weighing as much as a AAA battery on Earth, bounced up, then landed down, only to bounce again. The instruments on board were unharmed. But Philae landed in a crevice too dark for solar power. The race was on as the mission control team tried to download the data before Philae's battery was depleted. They managed to gather over 80% of the data they set out to capture from Philae before it went into hibernation. Then, in June 2015, they were overjoyed to hear Philae transmit again. As 67P approached the sun, the energy striking the comet increased, enough to bring Philae back to life. Using the data collected by both Rosetta and Philae's suite of high-tech instruments, scientists have been learning about the comet's chemical makeup on the surface and in its atmosphere. They've discovered four different organic compounds never before seen on a comet. From Philae's haphazard, bouncy landing, they discovered that parts of the surface are as soft as snow, while others are as hard as volcanic rock. Future missions could visit more distant comets from beyond the orbit of planet Neptune in the Kuiper Belt, or even beyond that in the Oort cloud, the vast bubble of billions of ice chunks home to the longest travelling comets. By studying a variety of these icy time capsules, scientists hope to find out how life started on the young planet Earth billions of years ago.
So Warwick Holmes's point is that if we join the European Space Agency, we could be part of missions such as the Rosetta one. Well, this has been the second of five Space Show programs in which we explore some of the space policy issues facing Australia. This series has been researched, written, narrated and produced by Andrew Rennie for The Space Show on Southern FM. Well, this is The Space Show, and it's organised by the Space Association of Australia, which is a non-profit, non-political group of space enthusiasts. And we're keen to learn about and share with others, such as yourself, the excitement of space exploration. Now, if you'd like some more information about the association or the issues discussed in this program, then you can contact us on the web internet. It's www.space.asn.au. So that's www.space.asn.au for more about that. And you can also link through to the Space Show website, which has more than 1,300 features for your listening enjoyment. I'm Andrew Rennie on Mission Control this evening. We've had Jay. Coming up is Mark Norman and Purple Haze.